How will machines make the media, the written, audio, and visual artifacts of the future? The path to understanding that future begins with the leading-edge work being done in the present. To explore the cutting edge in computational media creation, we welcome Manish Agrawala to the show. Manish is the Forrett Baskett Professor of Computer Science and Director of the Brown Institute for Media Innovation at Stanford University. His focus is on investigating how cognitive design principles can be used to improve the effectiveness of audiovisual media in order to discover the design principles and instantiate them in both interactive and automated design tools. My name is Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My partner is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 5 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in a world of AI automation. Let's get started. Creation is a process, not an event. Research, concept, making, and testing engage in an iterative and mutually informing dance until, finally, a thing is produced. It used to be, in an analog world, that thing was final and finished once the production button was pushed. Today, in the digital world, the iteration continues, sometimes indefinitely, as feedback leads to revision and enhancement. But regardless of whether the outcome is forever baked or perpetually changing, the basic processes of getting to a release are similar. And this similarity proves true whether we are talking about products, services, and experiences, or communication and media. In each case, creation requires some form of idea or concept, along with research to confirm, evolve, or improve it. This is followed by iterative making, where, for example, a draft is written, then reviewed and edited, perhaps many times. That review and editing might be done by the original writer, or a formal editor, or even friends, family, or strangers on the internet. It may even lead to larger changes, which take the work back to the concept and research phase. Doing this properly, to have the best chance of producing something memorable, is a craft. It requires care and effort and commitment. While it is surely possible to whip out something quickly, and even be lucky enough for that quick thing to be effective, the best work generally requires a greater investment of the creators. In communication, computers have been augmenting this process for decades. Rudimentary spell check and digital audio workstations date back to the 1970s, digitizing rote, manual, and monotonous tasks in the creationary process. We don't think of them as intelligence, and even though they are forms of automation, they weren't generally associated with automation. That term was reserved for industrial contexts that transformed factories full of humans to factories full of robots that were monitored and fixed by a smaller number of humans. That is changing with the AI and smartware of today. Increasingly, the word computational is appearing, serving as a signifier of smarter tools that, while they often still involve simple workflow improvement, also now enhance or even conduct problem-solving aspects of the work. No longer merely time savers, they are starting to enhance the thinking and overall quality of the final creations. With all of this in mind, let's welcome Manish Agrawala to the show. He oversees the work of student innovators in media and communication, even as he himself drives the creation of leading-edge tools that automate the creation of media, communication, and storytelling. Let's start by learning about his core interests.
What I think is interesting is that the way people communicate is becoming more and more visual. We used to communicate through voice quite a lot and then a bit through text. These days, a lot of the way that we communicate is very visual. We'll make presentations with high quality slides, we'll make videos, and so on. And in fact, I think teenagers, especially growing up today, are using imagery and video to communicate much more than ever before. What I'm really interested in is understanding how that kind of communication works and how we can build the tools to further harness that form of communication. If everyone could easily create video describing their ideas, it might make it much, much easier for people to understand those ideas and communicate have more clarity in the communication of those ideas.
One of the ways Manish is helping to lead this future is in his role as a co-leader of the Brown Institute.
The full name of it is the David and Helen Gurley Brown Institute for Media Innovation. And it was established in 2012 as an institute that is partly at Stanford in the School of Engineering. That's the part that I run, and partly in the Columbia School of Journalism. And the mandate of the institute is to think about new tools for creating media and also developing projects aimed at telling stories through that new media. We primarily fund student-led projects in either building tools, various kinds of journalism-related tools often, or in telling the stories, reporting and telling stories that make use of the new forms of media. So we've done a lot of work in VR, in AR, in internet-based interactive stories, and so on. On the story side, we have recently done some work on producing VR video, 360 video, about a story from South Sudan. It was reporting on the famine in South Sudan. And the neat thing about immersive 360 video is that it really brings you into the heart of the story. So in that video, we visit a food drop and we watch as the big, 50 and 100 pound packages of food are dropped on a location from the air. And we visit a hospital where some of the people that are suffering from lack of nutrition are being helped and so on. And the level of empathy that you get from this kind of immersive video is really quite amazing. And so that video is available even today. It was a co-production with Frontline Media, and you can find it on the web today. We also did a story on canners in New York. These are people that work in the streets of New York collecting recyclable cans and bottles, and it traces out the lives of these people that are called canners and their whole community and culture. And it has a very nice interactive kind of visualization of the routes that these people take and kind of the interactions that they have as they are going about their daily lives and finding these cans for recycling. Those are examples of the kinds of stories that we tell. And then on the technology side, that work on the story on the famine in South Sudan, that was also developed in the early days of 360 video. So we built our own kind of camera rigs and so on to capture all of that video and put it together in 360 form. More recently, we have been doing the work that is in my lab on trying to facilitate audio-video editing. That is all being supported through the Brown Institute. We have done some work on AR. So we have a project right now that is trying to take monuments in South Carolina that were monuments to figures in the Confederate War and replace them with monuments to people that were hurt by the Confederate War. So that's another example of kind of using technology to replace something that is not so easy to replace in the real world.
During season one, when we were focused on the topic of learning, VR was a technology that came up again and again as having promise in the educational process. These two examples happening at the Brown Institute illustrate how that can be powerful. Still, I wonder about how truly impactful VR can be. The moment in my own life that transformed me in the ways that the South Sudan VR aspires to was when I traveled to India as a 15-year-old. As an upper-middle-class white boy in the United States, my understanding of the world was one of relative plenty and comfort. I will never forget when we first landed in what was then called Bombay and drove from the airport to the bus in the gloaming of the early evening. On both sides of the road were people who appeared destitute, sitting or laying as if they lived right there, in that very spot, on the street. In my mind's eye, looking back 30 years ago, they were literally piled on top of each other. Whether that halcyon memory is precise, it goes without saying that I had never seen anything like it. And I was never the same, in the best possible way, after it. I struggle to imagine that the same experience as virtual reality, as opposed to just naturally encountering it in the real world, could have moved me in the same way. The gap between the virtual other and the real here seems vast. I asked Manish to follow up with this in mind.
I don't think it is the same level of intensity as the physical experience of being someplace. That said, there's a kind of intimacy that you can get in VR that just isn't possible when you're somewhat removed from a screen where you can see the edges of the screen. So there's a moment in the South Sudan video where we visit a mother that has a very young child, you know, just born, that is suffering from malnutrition. And you're right in, almost in the personal space of the mother and the child, and you can see the connection between them. And it is completely heartbreaking. And my experience is that there's a level of empathy there that you can get from that that is just very different from watching something on screen. And I think you're right. We still don't know exactly why this happens. It's something that we are hoping to study. In fact, I'll briefly mention, we have another project through the Brown Institute where one professor from Stanford, Jeremy Bellinson, and one professor from Columbia, Courtney Cogburn, they have joined together to develop a project called Thousand Cut. And the idea is to use VR to help people embody someone who is often very different from them. So that in their case, they are taking a young Black child and kind of tracing out his life from being a child to being a young adult to being an adult, and having a person inhabit this child's body. And it plays out as a series of vignettes that kind of show different points of racial tension in this person's world, in particular with respect to the police, with teachers, with other classmates, and so on. And this is also very, very affecting research. You know, there's a kind of empathy that you get by going through this experience that is very different from watching a movie or seeing something unfold in front of you.
I love the idea of putting us into the shoes of others whose experience is different from our own. That sort of experiential travel has the potential to help people who are culturally ignorant, in ways similar to my own teenage ignorance, to empathize with and develop not just tolerance of, but acceptance for those who are different from themselves. In co-leading the Brown Institute, Manish is overseeing those and other interesting storytelling projects. However, his own personal research is focused on automating the editing process for audio and video communication. Let's hear just what he is up to.
Imagine editing some video or editing this podcast, for example. A lot of the work that is involved is in finding the sections of the video or the audio that are of interest. And that itself requires scrubbing through the raw material back and forth until you find the pieces that you want, playing through it and kind of carefully looking for the most important pieces. And then once you've found them, you sort of have to cut them out and then reassemble them. And that work in today's editing interfaces is quite difficult. And so a lot of the work that we focused on for the last few years is to build interfaces that remove that tedium, but still allow a human author to go in and specify the places that might be of most interest. The key idea here is to think about the fact that most of today's audio-video editing interfaces require people, they force users to work with a timeline representation. So, you know, playing a timeline to play the video and listening to it in real time and trying to find the parts that are of most interest. And of course, when we think about a conversation that we've had, or we think about a raw recording of audio or video, we don't think in terms of the timeline when specific words were spoken. We think about the content itself. And so a lot of what we've done has focused on extracting a high-quality transcript of the speech in a video or in an audio segment, timelining the transcript to the speech so that you can then read the text, the transcript, click on a word, and jump to that part of the speech. That is a much better interface because it's more in line with the way we as authors think about the content itself.
To Manisha's point, existing editing tools abstract the content that we actually want and think about, the words and images, into timelines. These then form the foundation for how we navigate the content as we edit it. This is, to say the least, onerous. Here at Creative Next, we've hacked this process in order to empower audio engineer Michael Hermes to work directly with the words and more directly create the kind of output we want. This requires us to have the interview transcribed by a service that stamps time codes onto that transcription. From there, I go through the transcription, removing and rearranging things from the interview with a guest like Manish, to organize his statements in the ways to best align with the editorial story we are creating. In the process, I am highlighting in yellow the parts to include, leaving things to exclude without highlighting. Other highlighted colors are used as well, such as red, which says to Michael, include this in the recording, but also snip it as a separate file on its own for marketing purposes. Then, in between interview segments, I write the analysis script, what you are hearing at this very moment, to be separately recorded and woven in by Michael in the editing process. My part of the process, going from a raw transcript to handing Michael the marked up and fully written recording script, takes about a day of my time. It sure would be nice to automate more of this to take less time, but it's not clear to me how that would work. Much of what I do is narrative building and storytelling. The tools are cumbersome, but the process feels necessary. With all of that in mind, let's go back to Manish and hear at a more granular level what his software does.
Yeah, so there is some AI involved. It's maybe the older generation of AI, but the first step is we get that transcript and we very accurately time align it to the speech. And that already involves a hidden Markov model and sequence-to-sequence alignment. So there's a bit of AI in that. And then we've built kind of the interface around this tool to really make it much, much faster and easier to produce the final audio. Now, for audio, you don't need a lot. You can just take the audio snippets and kind of put them together, and it'll sound relatively seamless. There's some work we do to hide kind of the seams between the cuts. For video, that's much harder. So if I have, you know, a talking head video, for example, and I cut out a piece of it, maybe I cut out a phrase or cut out an or an then you'll see what's called a jump cut between the two pieces. And sometimes we want to eliminate those kinds of jump cuts. So we have technologies for doing that as well. So you couldn't do a lot of fine-grained cutting. So if I said or between every word, you wouldn't really be able to use that approach to hide all of the cuts of the uhs and ums, because there'd just be too many cuts, right? It would be an awkward-looking video what we do instead is provide a way to smoothly bridge the endpoints of those kinds of cuts.
I see. So Manisha's work is about automating Michael's process more than mine. I do try to smooth out what guests say by removing excessive ums, or removing a sentence or two where they were searching for the right word or phrasing, as just two examples. Rather than my doing a lot of micro work on the transcript that leads Michael to do a lot of tedious micro cuts, the software could simply do the cleaning. It's not going to reduce the amount of time I spend on the narrative stuff, but it will reduce some fiddly work for me and a whole bunch for Michael. Let's build on this to learn about how these technologies will extend to video and help be part of the film creation process of the future.
We've been doing some work on editing film semi-automatically. The idea is that when you have a scripted film, let's imagine a dialogue scene between a couple of actors, often a film director and cinematographer, they'll capture multiple takes of that scene to capture different voicings, to capture different actions, to just capture even slightly different dialogue and so on. And then the editor will really be responsible for finding the best parts of each take and kind of putting that together into what's commonly called a rough cut. And so we've been developing tools to try and facilitate that whole process of assembly of the takes. And the way it works is, again, we will get a transcript of the speech, time align it to each take, and then we do a bunch of video analysis. We figure out who's speaking at each line in the script. We figure out what the camera angle is, and so on. And then we allow you to control what the final edit would look like by providing kind of higher level idioms that suggest various kinds of editing styles to the system, and the system will take all of that and produce a rough cut of the scene.
There are a couple of different things going on here. Part of it is the automagic editing work to reduce rote and mundane tasks that people currently need to do. But another part of it seems to involve editorial or creative intelligence based on the idioms entered in by someone on the creative team. That moves into more of what we might think of as AI, where the machine is, even if relatively stupidly, acting in seemingly smart ways that are more than process improvement, tipping into creative decision-making. Let's dig more deeply into that.
There are some high-level rules built into the system, and we call those rules idioms. And the idioms might say, well, whoever is speaking, they should really appear on screen. When they are speaking, they'll specify rules like intensification. So when someone is saying something that is particularly important or emotional, the camera should zoom in on them and be in a close-up position. And then the system will try to identify which of the takes best matches all the rules and insert into that take into each slot in the dialogue. That's kind of the high-level idea that an author or a director or an editor would specify these high-level rules, the system would do the low-level work, the tedious work of cutting all of the different pieces out of the raw material and assembling it together into a rough take. We don't expect that our tools will produce the perfect result. You can think of this as kind of a quick rough cut that the director could then go back to and further massage and polish as necessary.
In the movie creation process, these sound like tools that might remove an entire role from the creationary team, or perhaps reduce tasks in a way that let the full-time jobs of two different people combine into just one job. But more than just professional-grade tools, Manisha's real interest is in changing the way consumers use and benefit from their personal content and media.
The tools that I am most interested in are tools that try and reduce the tedium of creating audiovisual media. Today, it is a lot of work to edit video. So today, we all carry around a device that allows us to capture really high quality audio and video. And some of us even will capture lots of video, but many of us never look at that video again, ever again. You know, it's just sort of sitting on my phone. One of the goals of the kinds of projects we take on is to unlock some of that material that we all have on our phones, to try and use the machine to find the parts of that raw material that are most interesting, and then surface that to us in ways that can keep our attention. and to do that by trying to edit it together in ways that have higher production values than what you get if you just look at the raw media alone.
As history has shown, and we've certainly experienced this in many of the things we've explored with guests on Creative Next, wonderful technology typically brings with it unintended consequences. What are some negative outcomes that might result from Manish's excellent work?
We've been seeing a lot of tools that allow you to create these kinds of deep fakes or fake video or manipulated video. And our tools could be seen as allowing that as well. I want to make the point that these tools have many, many positive uses. And perhaps the most important positive use is that these kinds of tools allow us to tell stories better, or they make it easier for us to tell stories. And, you know, at the heart of human culture is storytelling. And I really think that these kinds of tools, their primary use cases is to help other people create culture. You do a lot of cutting and pasting when you put together the podcasts that you create. And all of that is used in a positive way. The real issues with things like deepfakes are that people will manipulate the video and then claim that something happened that didn't actually happen. And that's, you know, that's lying. That's something that is possible with these tools, but is not a good use of the tool. You can think of it as a kind of Photoshop for video. I think there's been a real focus in the media on these negative uses of video manipulation, and it is something that we worry about. I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that people can use these in ways that are really bad for society.
We're going to return to these concerns again at the end of the interview. But for now, let's pivot to a vibrant area of applied computational technology, journalism. The field of computational journalism is fertile and growing, with esteemed and established programs at top research universities, including Stanford. Let's learn more about this fascinating field.
Journalism has really changed in the age of the internet, and every aspect of journalism, from, you know, thinking about what the stories are, to reporting the stories, to writing the stories or presenting them as video or audio, every aspect of journalism is changing. The advertising models are changing, the ways in which we experience the journalism are also changing. So every aspect of it is changing due to the internet and the widespread use of computation. And the idea behind computational journalism is to think about how computation can be used to facilitate each of these parts of the journalism process. At Stanford, we've been thinking a lot about where computational tools could be used by journalists to make their jobs easier and better.
This framing is important. The assumption is that computation can impact every aspect of journalism, and the field endeavors to explore and realize solutions that will transform the work of journalism across the entire continuum.
There are lots of steps to the process, and it's not a serial process by any means. One way to think about that process is that it starts by gathering facts and gathering data and identifying possible stories of interest. Computers can help in various ways in doing that. I mean, there's a wealth of data on the internet, and tools for kind of sifting and analyzing that data can help a lot. Once the information has been gathered, it needs to be further analyzed and then synthesized into a story. And there are various tools for doing that kind of synthesis. From the AI perspective, you've probably seen or heard of tools that will take a data set and turn it into a human readable story kind of generates the text content. And so there's another place where computation can come in. And then on the distribution side, certainly the internet is being used to distribute journalism in all kinds of ways. And that's of great interest. Business models are being redesigned, and computation plays a heavy role in that as well. So really every aspect of journalism, there are places where computation is already helping, and we're very interested in thinking through those processes.
Given the potential that computation has to impact all facets of journalism, how will this impact the work and life of a journalist? How can these people, whose training is largely not technical, best participate in our computational future?
Journalism is a big word. It covers lots and lots of different sub-areas. And what a breaking news journalist does is very different from what an investigative reporter does, and it's very different from what a movie reviewer does. So it's hard to say kind of, you know, what all these different types of journalists should do. But I think the one kind of overall thing is that journalism itself is changing. And so as a journalist, you want to be ready for changes to come into your process. The process is never a fixed thing. And I think more and more we will see that the process continues to evolve. And then I also think that journalists should be thinking about how they can evolve their process to make things easier or better.
And beyond computation, what are key issues facing journalism?
One of my feelings is that transparency is becoming more and more crucial. We're in an age right now where trust in journalism and media is eroding and has eroded pretty drastically. One way to rebuild the trust is to be more transparent about the news production process. What exactly was the process of gathering the facts and the data? How was the data analyzed? Can we provide a set of provenance tools that will allow anyone to come in and audit the whole process? That's a place where I think technology is heading and where we can really help journalism by making things much more transparent. There are lots of tricky issues around that as well. Complete transparency isn't always possible. Sometimes sources need to be protected in various ways. And so we need to also think about that.
Manish talked earlier about how the tools he is making to automate the creation of interactive media could be used to make fake content. Let's dig into that more deeply here.
The biggest concerns are around manipulating video, producing something that is untrue, and calling that true, and having that get out and people making decisions based on that lie. That's already proven very consequential. There have been incidents in other countries, in India, for example, where video that was untrue caused riots and other things. This is very concerning. Now, again, the tools are partly to blame here, but the bigger issue is that people are lying about what they've created. And often this kind of untrue video, this fake video or propaganda, it's actually unmanipulated video, but there's an interpretation of that video that has caused people to react, and that interpretation is somehow false. That's something that we really need to be concerned about.
I think a lot of us are already concerned about this, but from an expert's perspective, what can actually be done about it?
We need to think about how this kind of manipulation should be regulated. When you make a manipulated video, it should be clear that it has been manipulated. Maybe that's by context. If you're watching a fictional show, then it is, I think, clear that the video has been manipulated. And we probably need to think about permission from the person that has been manipulated as well. So I think regulation is likely where we're headed to curtail this problem. And then, you know, we can also think about technologies that can help deal with it.
There's a lot wrapped into these various short points. Likeness rights or more general permissions bump into existing law on one hand, and weird overlaps with the First Amendment on the other. Regulation is a hornet's nest by any measure, but doubly so in a global community whose laws, not to mention jurisdiction, vary wildly from one nation to the next, even as content is universally available, regardless of those inconsistent laws. Given how complex these nuances are, how can technology possibly help solve some of this?
One approach that people are taking is to build AI that can detect manipulation. I think that is a stopgap measure. I think there's an arms race here. And so any technology you build to detect manipulation, it'll be superseded by the manipulation technologies that don't leave that particular trace. So I think the kind of longer term solution, providing tools for provenance. Suppose, for example, we had a photograph, and from the moment that photograph was shot, it was signed by the photographer and the phone and put into a public database. And then every subsequent manipulation, you know, adjusting contrast, changing brightness, cropping the image, whatever was done to it, was registered in this publicly accessible database. You could then build a set of tools to go in and audit that photograph. And that's a way in which we might be able to provide much more transparency and let people ultimately themselves make the decision about whether the photograph is true or untrue. There's lots of social pressure to put out things that are true. Journalism outfits that are reputable know that they can lose their reputation if they start putting out lots of things that are false. And so that kind of pressure, I think, also prevents us from seeing really large-scale journalism outfits from publishing a lot of things that are fake and false.
Thanks again to our guest Manish Agrawala. So, John, how did our interview with Manish impact your thinking about the work we are doing with Creative Next?
Well, something that he was speaking about struck me, that there's this growing area of AI versus AI, much like the spy versus spy of, I don't know if you remember Mad Magazine, where there's these two goofy spies who battle each other. And in my head, I have this picture of this escalating arms race between AI. And what he said particularly was that there was artificial intelligence that could detect manipulated video or manipulated photos. Mm-hmm. And we, of course, know that there's all these deep fakes now. So, you know, we've seen some of these videos that where another person's face is transferred onto someone talking or making them, you know, seem like they've said something that they didn't. And it strikes me that this is not the kind of world that I'm looking forward to, where there's a constant escalation of fake material that is also has to be parsed on the consumer side by our, you know, the equivalent of antivirus software and, you know, viruses that infect your computer, that same kind of software escalation, which I imagine is only coming, and there's not much we can do about it. But that did strike me that there's this equal and opposite reaction that's happening, and I didn't like that very much.
Yeah, Manish actually had a big impact on this season beyond just this episode, which I really enjoyed having Manish on and hearing what he had to say. But I initially approached him because we were interested in computational journalism and wanted to have a guest or maybe even a couple guests covering that topic, and the Brown Institute, which Manish co-runs, computational journalism is one of their pillar topics. As it turned out, Manish's experience is less on the computational journalism side and more on the video side. And in his sharing the things that he shared, it led to a little bit of a change in the in the plan for what the season would be, and getting more into video and television and stuff, which was a cool and unexpected detour. So definitely had a big impact on the show from that way. John, what did Manish say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
Yeah, I thought his ideas around sort of rebuilding the trust model in journalism was interesting. Sort of the process and certification he described, and sort of introducing this what he deemed as a more transparent news production process. Exposing how facts and data are gathered and how it's analyzed, and whether or not there was a set of provenance that would allow someone, to come in and be able to audit it. So I think that that's a really fascinating way to sort of show, data and information provenance. I don't think anybody's going to care on the other side of it, because
really?
Yeah, I don't think anybody's going to care, because fake.
I'm going to care. I'm a somebody, John.
Yeah, but no one cares about fake news. It's just whether or not it matches your opinions, right? So you don't care whether or not it's correct. I mean, some people will, of course, but the kinds of discussions we're having now are not about, they're not factual discussions. So I think that's a sort of, I think it's an interesting idea, like what makes a set of facts real, but I think those already exist in journalism, and you can audit them already. I mean, it's just not for everybody to see.
Well, there's truth in your cynicism, but it's way too cynical.
I I'm sure we could do a whole show on this, but I don't think that showing sort of what amounts to a logical proof that, yes, these are the correct facts and this is how it was gathered and this is how it was analyzed and now we can discuss it. I think if you want to have a rational discussion, people who want to have those discussions already will have them.
Yeah, it's a question of degrees, though, right? I mean, it might not matter to highly partisan Bob on 123 Main Street, Anytown, USA, but it would certainly matter to the United States president to validate whether it's the real Vladimir Putin on a video or not, right? I mean, it depends on the context, I think. And for me, on Anytown, USA, I still do care too as a citizen.
Sure, but I think you're already looking for those factors, right? You're already looking for it.
Fair enough. Amen to that. Yeah, his provenance vision was fantastic. It was definitely the thing that impressed me the most as well. I don't think he used the word blockchain, but certainly what he proposes is an ideal application for blockchain. As we mentioned at the end of the show, Creative Next is a newsroom in the civil community, which is actually a fairly recent development, unfortunately one that coalesced sort of after the season was already baked, because I would have loved to do an episode on civil. In any event, at Civil, we're trying to serve citizens by providing information that enables them to fully participate in society, doing that in a variety of ways across the newsrooms, but one of them is leveraging blockchain for journalism. So at least in the day-to-day of Civil, it doesn't manifest in levering blockchain as provenance, but it certainly could, and frankly, it probably even should. So I'm generally interested and excited about blockchain and journalism thanks to Civil, but Manish's ideas on provenance and mapping those to blockchain, like, to me, it's a home run idea. Even if most people won't care, John, as you point out, at least there's some truth. There will be some record, the deep fakes, so to speak. There would be some way to see what was real and what was fake for the few who cared to. So what did you learn from Manish that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
Well, he made an interesting comment about the heart of human culture is storytelling. And I do think that that's sort of a critical at this juncture when we're sort of trying to decide what stories are we telling as a culture, as a society, as people, both in the United States and sort of around the world. I think we're asking, like, what are the, you know, what are the stories that are more important, and what are the ones that we're going to use to inform our decision making. So I thought that was an interesting lens to look at, to use to sort of view our current national discussions through a storytelling lens. Through that lens, I think it creates in some ways a less difficult to understand environment when you realize that these are narratives that people adhere to, not necessarily a particular partisan viewpoint, but rather, you know, a story, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm looking at content and media with a more skeptical eye. Obviously, things like fake news and deepfakes are not new to me, but it's also a little chilling to hear the details of what ethical people like Manish are working on and how easily they could accelerate the spread of disinformation. The technology is steaming forward, and, you know, it's not going to slow down. So all we can do is try to manage it and respond to it. For my own part, I'm cautious. My existing instinct to sort of hear the whole story or otherwise not leap to action or reaction based on what I see or hear is even more sensitive, considering these things really bring a discerning and critical eye. And I think that should probably be the case for all of us. Each episode, we finish up with a thing to think about, one question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, for the creation you do in your own work and life, what is a computational tool you can imagine that would be really amazing? Think about that for yourself, and feel free to tweet at us about it at GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is a proud member of Civil, a community-owned platform for independent journalism. Learn more at civil.co, that's civil.co. We are sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare, whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at goinvo.com. We're also sponsored by the Design Museum Foundation, a new kind of museum. They believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission? Bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is BIF. As a purpose-driven firm, BIF is committed to bringing design strategy where it is needed most: healthcare, education, and public service, to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect, visit them at biff.is. That's biff.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter at @GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish articles to extend and build upon these episodes. Check out all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach at @dniemeyer, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is at John Follett. Our guest is Manish Agrawala. If you want to get in touch with him, you can do so on Twitter, at @MAgrawala. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the hashtag CreativeNext. And the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. That's it for Creative Next Season 2, Episode 5, but here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
One of my concerns is, will automated technologies make us think that it doesn't matter that people get to tell their stories?